The Great Siege of Malta. This year is the 455th anniversary of one of the most inspiring, incredible, against all odds battles in history, and one of the most significant battles in all of history. 1565, the Great Siege of Malta. No compromise, no surrender, no retreat. In 1565, Islam was threatening all of Europe. The Ottoman Turkish Empire had conquered the entire Middle East, stretching all the way up to the gates of Vienna and conquering even Budapest. And of course, taking the whole of North Africa. They sacked what was once the greatest city in the world, Constantinople, which is now renamed Istanbul, massacring the entire Christian population. In 1526, the Turks had unsuccessfully besieged Vienna in the very heart of Europe. Muslim slave raiders were depopulating whole villages, coastal towns of Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, England, Wales, and Ireland. They were even raiding as far afield as Iceland and the Faroe Islands. Ultimately, 1.1 million Christian Europeans were kidnapped and enslaved by Muslim pirates in North Africa between 1500 and 1800. In fact, more European Christians were kidnapped by North Africans and taken to North Africa than were taken from West Africa into North America, which should boggle the brain, because remember, most of the slaves across the Atlantic went to South and Central America, especially places like Cuba and Brazil and Jamaica and so on. But North America, which everyone's making a fuss about, had less than 440,000 slaves enter it. And that means that more than twice as many Christian Europeans were enslaved by North Africans as Africans were enslaved by North Americans. Just an interesting piece of information there. And that's why American Marines went to the shores of Tripoli to rescue American seamen who had been kidnapped by slavers. And that's why France took Algeria and Italy took Libya and so on to stop the slave raids on southern Europe. One thorn in the side of the aggressive expansionism of the Ottoman Empire was the Christian island of Malta, just up between North Africa and Italy, just south of Sicily. You had this little rock in the Mediterranean, Malta. Malta was the headquarters of the last Crusaders. The Knights Hospitaller, also known as the Knights of St. John, the Order of St. John of Jerusalem. The Knights of St. John had proved to be the most tenacious enemies of Islamic Jihad. They were the last knights to leave the Holy Land. From the island of Rhodes, they had raided Islamic shipping, setting many thousands of Christian captives free from Islamic slavery. Often during severe sieges of Rhodes, their position in the Eastern Mediterranean became indefensible, and they sailed away, leaving that island to the Muslims when they ran out of all provisions and supplies and ammunition. The Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Charles V, offered the Knights of St. John the island of Malta as the new base for their operations. Not a very generous gift. It was just a rock with virtually no terrain that you could actually even harvest crops from. It was an extremely inhospitable rock in the middle of the sea. So it's not like Charles V was being awfully generous here. On the 26th of October, 1530, the knights sailed into Malta's Grand Harbour and soon turned this strategic island into a naval base from which they intercepted many Muslim slave raiders, endangering the lucrative Muslim piracy and slavery racket. Through the years, the Guerre de Corps, or the running battle between the Muslim slave raiding pirates and the Knights of St. John, continued unabated. This was an ongoing battle. As the Knights of St. John continued to interdict and harass the Turkish piracy route, Suleiman, the magnificent vice-regent of God on earth, lord of the lords of the east and west, possessor of men's necks, king of believers and unbelievers, majestic Caesar, and on, I mean, it's just the short part. There's a lot more his praise singers had to rant and rave about. He mobilized the largest armada yet seen with 193 ships, 40,000 fighting men, including 6,300 of the elite Janissaries, the invincible ones. Well, that was the name. The objective, to wipe out the Knights of St. John off the face of the earth and capture the strategic island of Malta for Islam. So long as Malta remains in the hands of the Knights, so long will relief from Constantinople to Tripoli run the danger of being taken or destroyed. This cursed rock is like a barrier interposed between us and your possessions. In other words, the things you're going to loot and the people you're going to enslave. This was not the first time the Turks had attempted to seize Malta. In 1551, the Corsair Turgot Reis had invaded the island with a force of 10,000 fighting men. As this attempt failed, Turgot withdrew and bombarded the neighboring island of Gozo. After the population surrendered and opened their gates of their city, the Muslims looted the town, enslaved virtually the entire population of 5,000 people. This taught the people of Malta it does no good to surrender to these people. As a result of the failed siege of 1551, the Knights of St. John strengthened Fort St. Angelo, their main fort at the tip of Burgu, and they also constructed two new forts, Fort St. Michael on Sengalere and Fort St. Elmo, protecting the entrance to the Grand Harbour on Mount Skirribas. Now, all three of these forts proved crucial in the Great Siege of 1565. The Grand Master of the Order of St. John, Jean de Valette, began vigorous preparations to enable Malta to survive in an extended siege. A lockdown, I think you could have called it. In May 1560, the Ottoman victory in the naval battle of Djerba captured or sunk about half the vast Spanish naval expedition which had sought to evict the corsairs, the pirates, from Tripoli. This disaster marked the highest point of the Ottoman-Turkish domination of the Mediterranean Sea. As his espionage network informed him of the imminent invasion, de la Valette set about accumulating stores, ammunition, strengthening fortifications, recruiting further fighting men, recalling all knights to Malta. And by the way, this is what a knight's kit would have looked like in 1560. You can see you've got your under padding, but you've got mail, which is thousands of little rings interlocking. That's sort of what the Vikings used. But then you've got your plate armor, and then you've got your uniform over it, and you can see from the shoes, you've got to be pretty fit just to wear this kind of armor and walk around it. But then, of course, you've got different types of helmets and visors, and all the way down, don't forget the crucifix. And, of course, you've got your sword, you've got your dagger, and you've got your pike. And that would be pretty basic equipment for the average fighting man of the Knights Hospitaller. This is the reality of Europe. Notice the red with the yellow crescent. The Turks control the whole of North Africa, most of the Mediterranean. They've got not just the old Byzantine Empire, Turkey, but they've also got Greece, what today is Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, all the way through what today is Croatia, Serbia, right up to and including parts of Hungary and Austria is being dominated right then by the Turks. So that's the reality. And just below Sicily, you've got Malta sticking out. And here you get a pretty good idea of the Ottoman Turks control a vast amount. They even conquered Budapest there. And you can see Vienna is just beyond their reach, but they'd certainly tried very hard to get there too. And Malta is what you would think is insignificant, but from a naval point of view, they were interdicting the supplies from the eastern to the western Mediterranean, and that was a key part of the strategic significance. And by the way, just notice while we're about it, at this stage, a good part of Ukraine and the Crimea is in the hands of the Turks. The Russians liberated Sevastopol and the whole of the Crimea from the Turks in the 1700s, and in fact, the Russians have owned Crimea longer than America's owned Hawaii. And so for people to talk about Russia invading Crimea is a bit ridiculous because it's been Russian for centuries. And they took it from the Turks, who certainly had no right to it. So, but that's another matter. So here you've got the political background. Here you've got the geographic background, and you can see where they fit. The official historian of the order, Giacomo Bozzio, recorded that the Turkish fleet consists of 193 vessels, including 131 galleys. Remember, galleys are rowed. They've got sails, but mostly it's Ben-Hur battle speed type of drumming rowing. 7 galleots, which are much bigger than a galley. 11 large merchant ships, which are supply ships, one of which alone held 600 armed men, 6,000 barrels of gunpowder, and 1,300 rounds of cannonball. Balbi de Corregio, in his famous siege diary, which is a major source of information about this battle, records that the Turkish invading force included 6,300 Janissaries. That's the elite. the Invincibles, over 6,000 Spahis, meaning cavalry, 4,000 religious fanatics, their terms, 2,500 Spahis from Romania, 500 Spahis from Karamania, 6,000 other volunteers, various corsairs, meaning pirates from Tripoli and Algeria, totaling 48,000 fighting men in all. That's not counting the camp followers, the cooks, the slaves, the people carrying bearing and so on and so forth, which was a huge other, what they call camp followers. On the Christian side, there were less than 700 Knights of St. John. In fact, at the beginning, there was only something like 500 and something, but they got a little bit of resupplies later, so I'm taking the total. 400 Spanish soldiers, 800 Italian soldiers, 200 Greek and Sicilian soldiers, approximately 3,000 soldiers drawn from the Maltese population, along with other civilians who were given weapons, barely a militia. And if you count the militia and the civilians given some weapons, total force of less than 9,000 men, of which you've only got actually a couple of thousand of real trained soldiers, and the core of it is a few hundred knights. The Grand Master of the Order of St. John, Jean de la Valette, was 71 years old when this battle began. He had been a Knight of St. John since he was 18 years old, meaning he had spent 53 years in the Knights of St. John. De la Valette was a veteran of the Siege of Rhodes in 1922. De la Valette had survived a year as a galley slave for the Ottoman Turks, rowing up to 20 hours a day in a Muslim galley. Think Ben-Hur. The lash, that sort of thing. Valletta challenges knights. It is a great battle of the cross and the Quran, which is now to be fought. A formidable army of infidels are on the point of invading our island. We, for our part, are the chosen soldiers of the cross. And if heaven requires the sacrifice of our lives, there can be no better occasion than this. Let us hasten then, my brothers, to the sacred altar. There we shall renew our vows and retain by our faith in the sacred sacraments, that contempt for death, which alone can render us invincible. When the knights left the church, they were filled with enthusiastic joy. It was reported that after the service, every kind of weakness disappeared, and all divisions between them, all private animosities, ceased. Now, considering the multinational, multilingual group that was present there, though even a few English and German volunteers amongst a wide range, almost every representation. There were some people from Norway. So the Knights of St. John encompassed virtually every single area and country in Europe at that time. The Knights of the Order of St. John of Jerusalem were devout. They were aristocratic. They were warlike. They boasted the bluest of blood amongst their members. They came from some of the finest houses in Europe. They were military monks. This is something quite unique during the Crusades. They developed military orders where people joined a religious order for the sole purpose of fighting Turks, protecting the Holy Land, protecting pilgrims going to the Holy Land, and to keep Christians safe from Muslim attackers. And so there were soldiers who were in a religious order, something that was quite unique. They developed an efficient security service, providing armed escorts for Christian pilgrims throughout the whole dangerous Holy Land, and after the success of the First Crusade, they became a military order in 1113. Young aristocrats from Spain, Portugal, England, France, Germany, Italy enthusiastically joined the Knights of St. John. The Knights became recognized as the very front line of the battle for Christendom, a bulwark to keep Europe safe from Islamic jihadists who, bear in mind, had controlled Spain just a very short time before, and at that point were controlling Budapest and threatening Vienna. The Knights of St. John were respected as the toughest soldiers in Christendom. They were the elite. In 1522, 7,000 knights and soldiers on the island of Rhodes resisted over 90,000 of the Sultan's forces for 6 months. And only when all their supplies were exhausted and no possibility of continuing the fight remained, they'd run out of everything from food to ammunition, did the Knights of St. John board their ships and withdraw in good order, leaving the island of Rhodes for the Muslims. So we come to 1565, the great siege of Malta. As the sun rose on the 18th of May, 1565, the horizon filled with white sails and blazoned with the Sultan's red crescent. The great siege of Malta had begun, and the invaders were supremely confident they would be able to overwhelm and subjugate the small band of knights on the island of Malta. And so you can see here, this part of the Grand Harbour is controlled by the St. Ermelo and by the knights, by Saint Michael and Angelo, and therefore the Muslim ships came into the other harbour because the Grand Harbour was denied them because of those forts. Here's a basic rundown again of the scoreboard, how many knights he had at the beginning. At the beginning, they only had 500 knights, but they got some resupplies during the battle, during the siege. And you can see all the way down, less than 9,000 on the Christian side, 48,000 on the Islamic side. And these are the three great forts. Fort St. Elmo's at the point, guarding at Mount Skirabas, the entrance to the Grand Harbour. Fort St. Angelo is the biggest and most important. Fort St. Michael is protecting the island extension over there on Sengala. And this is how the great siege actually developed. The first target was Fort St. Angelo, and then they would focus on, after St. Elmo, it would be on St. Angelo and on St. Michael. And here you get a pretty good grasp of it. You've got the Mediterranean Sea, you've got Gallows Point, Fort St. Elmo. Here we've got Dragonet Point, that's actually named after one of the Muslim leaders who came that way. And Mount Skirabas is where the Muslims set up most of their camp, where they could threaten both sides and mount their attack on St. Elmo. Here you've got Bergi, which is the main town with Fort St. Angelo protecting it, and Fort St. Michael protecting Sengalia. And here the Corridon Heights, where these red cannon are indicating where the Muslims placed the artillery. So that's basically a bird's eye view of the attacks. Their first target was Fort St. Elmo. If you've heard of St. Elmo's fire, this is what we're talking about. This is where it all came from. St. Elmo dominated the entrance to the Grand Harbour. A mere 100 knights and 500 soldiers held St. Elmo. De La Valette had ordered them to fight to the last man, no retreat. The length of their survival would determine the outcome of the whole campaign. They knew it was basically a suicide mission. The Turks had estimated they would need just 3 days to bombard St. Elmo to submission. Yet the garrison of St. Elmo held on through an incredible 35 days of constant bombardment and waves of assault. All of Europe was praying fervently, realizing what was at stake. Even Protestant Queen Elizabeth of England declared, if the Turk should prevail against the Isle of Malta, it's uncertain what further peril might follow to the rest of Christendom. And there were a few English volunteers even fighting there, because this was way past Protestant-Catholic rivalries, because they recognized this is Christian against Muslim. This is the whole of Europe at stake here. And so even the Protestants were behind this battle. Mustafa Pasha ordered the great siege guns to be dragged to Mount Skirabas. Two 60-pound culverins. Now, a 60-pounder means it fires a cannonball 60 pounds, roughly 30 kilograms. That's heavy. 10 80-pounders and an enormous basilic firing a solid 160-pound shot. Think of an 80-kilogram cannonball. Just imagine what that does when it hits a wall. And these were brought for the attack on St. Elmo. After a week of preparation and bombardment by such heavy artillery, when they were digging trenches closer and closer to St. Elmo, bringing the cannons closer and closer, and the artillery were bombarding the sandstone and the lime block composing the fort of St. Elmo began to crumble. The Turks relentlessly pounded away at the small fort. After the first night of bombardment, the besieged knights made a sortie, meaning they sallied out. You know, any castle's got a sally port. Been to the castle in Good Hope. You see that little sally port's a very narrow little gateway where you can quickly sally out. It's not the main gate, but you can surprise the men. And that's any good fort's got that. And so they lowered the drawbridge stealthily, captured the closest enemy trench, wiped out everyone in it. But Mustafa anticipated something like this. He ordered the Janissaries to go forward, and the Janissaries stormed the trenches, but they were cut down by the cannon of St. Elmo. The arrival of Drajut, known amongst the Muslims as the drawn sword of Islam. He is the best commander that the Ottomans had. He is known as the scourge of the Christians. This encouraged the Ottoman forces. He brought another 1,500 of his elite warriors. And Drajut noticed what Mustafa had missed. St. Elmo was being resupplied every night from across the bay from St. Elmo. Every night they'd have boats going across and resupplying more men, more ammunition, and so on. As the artillery bombardment of St. Elmo doubled in intensity, the defenders tried to erect counter walls behind the crumbling outer walls. So they'd be rebuilt, they'd be building new walls with the rubble behind. So if they stormed the one wall, now they're going to need another inner wall. At this time, word reached De La Valletta that their relief force that they were hoping for from nearby Sicily had been seriously delayed. This is criminal to think that any relief force, when all that's hanging on it, that Europe took so long to send any relief force, and now they're delayed. Valletta read the dispatch to his council, declared, "We now know that we cannot look to others for our deliverance. It is only upon God and our own swords that we must rely." Yet this is no reason to be disheartened, rather the opposite. For it is better to know the truth of one's situation than be deceived by false hopes. Our faith and the honor of our order is in our own hands. We shall not fail. On the 3rd of June, a new battery erected on Tigny Point opened up a steady fire in St. Elmo. Then the Janissaries attacked. They swarmed over the reduced ravelin. A ravelin is the outer defense. If you've been to the Castle of Good Hope, there's the outer ravelin. Only one of them can be seen now, but used to be around the whole fort. So you'd have an outer defense. Once they get over that, then in a kill zone for the main wall to be able to pour fire on them. They wiped out the exhausted survivors. Then they stormed towards the gates of Elmo, but the cannon protecting the portcullis opened fire on the advancing ranks of Janissaries. The defenders of St. Elmo used burning hoops to set ablaze the white-robed Turks, throwing these, we use these hoops for sports. They set them ablaze and threw them over the Turks. Arbuses, that's old shotguns, spread out a lot, and blocks of stone met the Muslims, and cauldrons of boiling pitch set many of the invaders aflame. In fact, some describe them using Greek fire, which is a form of almost ancient napalm. From dawn until noon, the battle raged around the bridge and the walls of St. Elmo, yet the flag of the Knights of St. John still waved above the ramparts, engulfed in flames and smoke. This is the famous, the flames of St. Elmo. It's every night that see the flames of St. Elmo still raging. Wave after wave of Janissaries were unleashed upon St. Elmo, and by the time Mustafa called off his troops, over 2,000 of the elite Janissaries lay dead, as opposed to 10 knights and 70 Maltese soldiers who had died defending St. Elmo that day. A report from St. Elmo sent that night on one of the supply boats that went back, pounded by hostile cannon, in arms always, and prepared for combat, by day exposed to the burning sun and by night to the cold and the damp, privation of all sorts, from the blast of gunpowder smoke, dust, wildfire, iron and stones, musketry, explosions of enormous batteries, insufficient nutriment, so disfigured we hardly know each other anymore, ashamed of retiring for wounds not manifestly quite dangerous or almost mortal, those with the smaller bones dislocated or shattered, and livid faces bruised with frightful sores, or extremely lame and limping woefully, those miserably bandaged around the head and arms in slings, strange contortions. Such figures were frequent and nearly general. The Turkish gunfire was so heavy it seemed as if they were determined to reduce the fortress to powder. On Thursday, another Turkish attack was blasted by hail of bullets and incendiary weapons. Yet the defenders came under such sustained fire they could not barely show themselves above the battlement. When the commander suggested the fortress be evacuated and burned to the ground, Valletta reminded him, "We swore obedience when we joined the order. We swore also on the vows of chivalry that our lives would be sacrificed for the faith. Whenever and wherever the call may come, our brethren in St. Elmo must now accept that sacrifice." The knight sent a further message urging, "Do not send any further reinforcements, since there will be no more than dead men." They requested permission to storm the enemy and die honorably in battle rather than remaining pounded behind the walls. Valletta responded, "The laws of honor cannot necessarily be satisfied by throwing away one's life when it seems convenient. A soldier's duty is to obey. You will tell your comrades that they are to stay at their posts. They are to remain there and they are not to sally forth." They were tying down and bleeding the enemy, buying time. La Valletta sent another 15 knights and almost 100 soldiers, all volunteers, to strengthen the garrison at St. Elmo. The Ottomans stormed the fort repeatedly and were repulsed time and again. The first great night attack of the siege took place 10 June. When dawn broke, 1,500 of the Sultan's troops lay dead or dying in no man's land between the ravelin and the fort. St. Elmo's losses that night totaled 60. The Turkish commander-in-chief ordered the Christians there might retire unmolested. So the Turks are saying, you can go free. And each one resolved they'd rather die where they stood and give no quarter. They would not even take this offer to save their lives by retiring. On the night of 15 June, the whole Turkish fleet ringed the fort and 4,000 cannon opened up on St. Elmo. Then the Layalas, the fanatical core of jihadists on drugs, these are the religious fanatics, launched a frenzied attack. They were followed by a horde of dervishes. You've heard of the whirling dervishes. These people come from what today is Sudan. Then the Janissaries followed, and each attack was decimated and sent fleeing by the ferocious defense of the Knights of St. Elmo. Another 1,000 of the Turks perished that day, and 150 of the garrison of St. Elmo perished. On the 18th of June, La Valletta called for more volunteers to reinforce St. Elmo. The longer it can stand, the better. 30 more knights, another 300 soldiers came forward and volunteered and rowed across the harbor to the beleaguered and bombarded garrison of St. Elmo. That same day, Drajut, the commander-in-chief, was mortally wounded by cannon shot as the drawn sword of Islam was carried back to his tent. Morale amongst the invading Turks was seriously weakened. As St. Elmo was pummeled by concentrated bombardment, it seemed incredible that anything couldn't exist in that smoking ruin. You've heard of people in the First World War suffering shell shock. Well, these people had every reason to suffer from shell shock, you can imagine. As Janissaries breached the walls, Chevalier de Monstert directed cannon fire against the center of the Janissary attack and saved the day. That day, St. Elmo lost 200 men and the Turks over 2,000. On dawn of the 23rd of June, the Ottoman galleys surround the ruined fort and unleashed more death and destruction upon the valiant defenders of St. Elmo. Cannon volleys. Less than 100 defenders remained. They sang hymns. They prayed. They defiantly tolled their chapel bell. They prepared to meet the Lord Jesus. Some could not even stand. They were seated in chairs, fully armed, ready to fight from a seated position because they could not even stand. Incredibly, they held out for yet another hour. As Mustafa Pasha carried the banner of the Sultan Suleiman to replace the flag of St. John on St. Elmo's ruins, he gazed at the massive fort St. Angelo across the bay and cried out, Allah, if such a small sum has cost us so dear, what price shall we have to pay for so large a father? The 35 days of ferocious courage of the defenders of St. Elmo had cost the invaders precious time and over 9,000 of their best troops. Most of the Janissaries lay dead. Mustafa Pasha now ordered the bodies of the knights to be decapitated, the heads placed on stakes and the corpses nailed to crosses to be floated across the harbor. As the headless bodies of crucified knights washed up at the base of Fort San Angelo, La Valletta ordered the Turkish prisoners to be executed and the heads used as cannonballs to bombard the Turks. The message was clear. The knights would fight to the very death. No quarter would be given and no quarter would be received. And it sounds very harsh to us, but they were not just fighting for their lives, but they were also fighting a psychological war. The morale of the defenders of Malta was lifted when four galleys from Sicily managed to evade the Turkish blockade and land a small relief force of 42 knights and 700 militia. Not a lot, but every little bit counts at a time like this. I mean, every volunteer means a lot. Siege guns were transported to the height of Corradino to begin the bombardment of Fort San Angelo and St. Michael and the villages of Burgu and Sengali. 70 cannon from Mount Skiribus and Gallows Point and Trigny Point and Mount Salvatore and from the heights of Corradino opened up a heavy crossfire on San Angelo and St. Michael and the villages of Burgu and Sengali. So you can see now they're directing fire from Mount Skiribus, from Gallows Point, from Trigny, over here, from every side, all the heights around, and they're being bombarded from every direction it can be. On the morning of the 15th of July, Mustafa ordered the first major assault by both land and sea. The Algerian troops stormed the walls of St. Michael from the landward side, and the Turks landed troops to storm the seaward walls, and Algerians came on screaming with a wild rush. And the Christians counterattacked and turned the tide of the battle. And as the Muslim invaders fled, Mustafa sent in his masterstroke, 1,000 of his elite Janissaries aboard 10 large boats to land at the northern wall, while the Christian defenders were preoccupied defending the southern wall. What Mustafa did not know was that Vella Ette had positioned a battery of artillery at the base of St. Angelo to counter just such an eventuality, which he expected. Chevalier de Garal, who commanded the 5-gun battery at the base of St. Angelo, would have been at about this point here, could scarcely believe his eyes as he saw Janissaries sailing straight towards the muzzles of his cannon. At the ideal target range, he ordered his men to open fire. 9 of the 10 boats were sunk and 800 Janissaries disappeared into the water. Only the 10th boat managed to survive and flee back across the harbour, and the few Janissaries who managed to make it to land received St. Elmo's pay, which was the term now for no mercy. That's the way you treated our people over there. This is how we treat you over here. The knights opened the gates and charged the Muslims and sent them fleeing. Following the humiliation of 15 July, Mustafa adopted a more cautious approach. Depending upon his artillery to reduce the walls and undermine the morale of the defenders by incessant bombardment. From north and south, from east and west, the Christian fortresses came under withering and sustained artillery barrage. The Turks gave the besieged no respite. The bombardment continued all day and all night. Throughout the last week of July, at dawn on the 2nd of August, the Turks advanced while all their cannon thundered at once. People in Sicily over 100 kilometers away could hear the cannon fire. It reminds one of how people in England could hear the cannon of the Battle of the Somme in France. It was the heaviest bombardment of the siege, and it seemed impossible that any person could live through the sustained fire, let alone be in any state to fight in the crumbling ruins of the fort. From every ridge and slope, Muslims swarmed forward like a tidal wave against the garrisons. Yet attack after attack was repulsed, and Mustafa was once again forced to concede defeat. As his exhausted, decimated assault troops withdrew, Mustafa decided to subject the Christians to another 5 days of continuous bombardment before attempting the next assault. In all, over 130,000 cannonballs were fired from the Turkish guns against the Christian defenders of Malta. Throughout the siege, the women, the children, worked alongside the soldiers to repair the walls, repair the defences, prepare the bombs and ammunition. There was no such thing as civilian in a case like that because they were all at risk. And so all the people who had fled from the farmlands and come behind the walls, they all had to help with maintain the walls and build new walls within, shore up the damaged walls. And it was all for their own good. So there was complete, total involvement from everybody, right down to the smallest, for carrying water to the soldiers and all the rest. On the 7th of August, the Islamic assault was renewed, and like a tsunami, the enemy rushed upon Burgu and Singali simultaneously. Yet as they swept over the ditch, half filled with rubble from the walls, and through the breaches of the wall blasted by continuous cannon fire, they were confronted by another interior wall. The troops had poured in through the outer breaches now came under withering fire from the garrison, and unable to turn back because of the weight of their numbers pressing behind them, they were trapped in a narrow killing ground where they were slaughtered in their hundreds. Then the Christian defenders leapt from their entrenchments and stormed the faltering defenders. The Muslims turned and fled, slipping and sliding on the blood of their comrades and tripping over the mounds of dead bodies as they fled from the fight. Yet, while the Turkish attack on St. Angelo was routed, the assault on St. Michael was succeeding. Turkish flags began to appear upon the ramparts, and it was at this point that the governor of Medina, the capital of Malta, which is on the hinterland, launched his cavalry force. The cavalry force was kept there for just such purpose as this, against the lightly guarded Turkish headquarters. While all the Turks were involved in the attack, they didn't expect a threat from inland of Malta. The Christians overwhelmed the sentries, killing every man they could find, capturing or destroying a huge store of provisions and ammunition. As a messenger galloped to Mustafa to inform that a large Christian force of cavalry had swarmed over the camp, Mustafa feared the worst. He assumed this was the relief force from Sicily. And Mustafa ordered a general retreat, and this way Fort St. Michael was saved, even though the Muslims were at the point of victory there. However, there was no relief force. Valletta called his council together at night and informed his men, "I will tell you now openly, my brethren, that there is no hope to be looked for except in the succor of Almighty God, the only true help. He who has looked after us until now will not forsake us, nor will he deliver us in the hands of the enemies of the holy faith. We are soldiers and we shall die fighting. If by any evil chance the enemy should prevail, we can expect no better treatment than our brethren who were in St. Elmo. Let no man think that there can be any question of receiving honorable treatment or escaping with his life. If we are beaten, we will all be killed. It would be better to die in battle than terribly and ignominiously at the hands of the Muslims. There would be no more talk about relief forces, he said. With the greatest devotion, with the firmest hope and faith that they'd be received into glory, the resolve to die for the cause. The Muslims began to tunnel under the defences to plant mines. With a tremendous explosion, the bastion of Castile, the landward defence to Sengalir, collapsed. And as the survivors staggered back in confusion, waves of Turks swarmed through the breach. Valletta seized a pike and boldly ran from his command post towards the breach. Seeing the Grand Master, man in his 70s, running to the point of danger, all the knights and soldiers joined him in turning back the tide of Islamic advance. A grenade exploded near Valletta and the knights rushed to defend him. Withdraw, sire, to a place of safety. Valletta refused. The enemy is already in retreat, they said. Valletta continued to advance against the enemy, declaring, as long as their banners still wave in the wind, I will not withdraw. The knights and soldiers surged forward with incredible tenacity until within a few minutes the Turks were routed and fleeing in disarray. There was no darkness that night. Gunfire lit up the sky, cannon pounded the walls, yet the Christians stood firm and by dawn the Muslims had withdrawn in defeat. Now Mustafa unleashed a siege tower, which was higher than the walls, and Janissaries were using its platform to fire upon the defenders of Burgu. Valletta had his workmen burrow a hole in the base of the tower facing the wall. They wheeled out a large cannon which fired two large cannonballs fastened together by a chain. And this chain shot sliced through the structure, causing it to collapse, spilling Turks, incendiary grenades and fuel, which sent the giant tower ablaze. On 20th of August, the Turks brought up another larger siege engine, reinforced at the base with earth and stonework. The knights of St. John now sallied out and stormed the tower in a surprise sortie, swept up the laddered floors, eliminating all the Janissaries in a matter of minutes. They then turned the siege engine into an additional fighting platform to defend the walls, and the two Turkish cannon on it poured more fire into the dismayed Muslims. That's what you call seizing the initiative. Carpe diem. Seize the day. At this point, Mustafa learned that a large supply ship from North Africa to replenish their dwindling supplies of ammunition and food had been captured by a Christian galley. Christian pirates, counter pirates. Despondency swept the Turkish camp. They were now running so short of gunpowder that they had to suspend the bombardment. Thousands of Turks were laid low with sickness. Even water and food was now in short supply for the attackers. This island is very inhospitable. Mustafa now determined to capture the capital, Medina, and use it as his winter quarters. Anticipating the Muslims' intentions, the governor of Medina dressed the civilians in soldiers' uniforms, had them patrol the ramparts along with the garrison, and all available cannon were brought to the side from which the Turkish assault would approach. As the Muslims toiled up the long slopes to the city, they were shocked to see the walls bristling with cannon and armed men, and as they came within range, actually they were basically still without range, the cannon opened up, which indicates we've got so much ammunition to spare, you know, we can even shoot when you're not quite within range. The dismayed Turks halted and turned back. It's another impregnable position. It's another St. Elmo's. And so they gave up before they'd started. The Turks launched another attack on St. Angelo and St. Michael on the 1st of September. But their men were by now so drained and disheartened and reduced in number and enfeebled by fever and dysentery that the attack failed almost before it had begun. It is not the will of Allah that we should become masters of Malta, was the general consensus. On the 5th of September, Viceroy Don Garcia set sail from Sicily with a relief force made up of professional soldiers from all over Europe, including many Italians, Germans, French, and other European volunteers, even from England. The relief force consisted of 10,000 fighting men in 28 ships. When news of the relief arrived, 8th of September, Mustafa's army was on the verge of mutiny. The Turkish fleets had lost the will to fight. They did not even attempt to contest the landing. As the invaders began to embark, Mustafa learned that the relief force was actually smaller than his army, so he ordered his men back ashore. The relief force charged the Muslims, and the fierce battle slaughtered 3,000 of Mustafa's army, driving the remainder into the sea. Valletta now rushed light cannon up to St. Elmo and fired upon the retreating fleet, and the day the Muslims fled Malta was 11 September 1565. The bells of the churches rang over the shattered houses of Berger, and the victors sang Te Deum, to God be the glory, to God who grants victories. Nearly 250 knights of the Order of St. John had lost their lives in the great siege. The survivors were all wounded, many crippled for life. Of the original 9,000 garrison, barely 600 were still capable of any fighting. The Turks had lost over 30,000 men. The Sultan Suleiman was devastated when he heard of this defeat. Next year, I myself, Sultan Suleiman, will lead an expedition against this accursed island. I will not spare one single inhabitant, he declared. But the following year, before he could carry out his threat, Suleiman died at age 72. At the beginning of his reign, Suleiman had been defeated before the walls of Vienna in 1529. Now, at the end of his reign, his army had suffered the most humiliating and decisive defeat at Malta, and losing his top commander at that. The Ottoman Turks never attempted to besiege Malta again. The failure of the siege denied the Turkish forces control of the Western Mediterranean and prevented their plans to conquer southern Europe. The Great Siege of Malta was one of the most decisive victories in military history, changing the course of history and preventing the Western expansion of Turkish power. All of Europe rejoiced in celebrating the victory, and in Malta the church bells rang out triumphantly. Honours were showered upon the Grand Master Valletta by all the kingdoms of Europe, and at last the Knights of St. John received the generous financial contributions that they needed to rebuild the ruined cities and fortresses of Malta. Italian engineer Francesco Zapparelli helped build a magnificent citadel, which was to be called Valletta, named after the hero of the siege of Malta. Valletta is built on Mount Skidobus, including the site of St. Elmo, Fort St. Elmo, and the whole area which a Turkish camp had encompassed. And so you've got the old Bergu and Sengale, Fort St. Elmo, but now the main capital is over the whole of Mount Skidobus, and tremendous fortifications. They built such fortifications that no Turks would ever think of trying to attack Malta again. And this is what Valletta looks like. And that's where Fort St. Elmo would have been back then. But of course, the original has been totally reduced to rubble, now rebuilt. The Cathedral of St. John in Valletta is described by Sir Walter Scott as the most magnificent church in all of Europe. And here you've got just some of the artistic depictions. This is of the Siege of Medina, the town on the hinterland. And you can see, not only are they fighting, but the Lord is fighting for them, and so are the angels. When he died, La Valletta was buried in a great crypt in the Cathedral of St. John, where the inscription reads, "Here lies Valletta, the scourge of Africa and Asia, the shield of Europe, whence he expelled the barbarians by his holy arms." The heroic defense of Malta against such overwhelming odds for over 4 months of relentless bombardment and assault inspired all of Europe to renewed efforts to defeat the Turkish menace. And victory over Islam multiplied. In 1571, the Turkish fleet was decisively annihilated at the Battle of Lepanto, the largest battle of rowing fleets, galleys. The last great Turkish threat to the heart of Europe was defeated at the gates of Vienna, 11 September 1683. As Vienna was besieged and bombarded, and it looked like there was no hope, suddenly the Polish hussars arrived, German infantry, and they swept down and they annihilated the Turks in one of the most decisive defeats ever. And by the way, from the defeat of the Turks on 11th of September 1683 came coffee and cappuccino and croissants, because in the tents of the Muslims they found lots of coffee, and there was a Capuchin monk who enterprisingly took the coffee and opened up a shop which became known as Cappuccino, that he was serving. And the bakers made a crescent-shaped pastry to celebrate that they had the Muslim for breakfast, and that became known as the croissant when Marie Antoinette married the Dauphin, who later became King Louis XVI and went to France. And so the French term for crescent is a croissant. And so the croissant also comes from the siege of Vienna being lifted in 1683, also 11 September, surprisingly. Malta was one of the first nations in Europe to embrace Christianity after the Apostle Paul's shipwreck on the island of Malta, which you can read about in the Book of Acts. Malta is the highest church attendance of any country in Europe, also the most hostile to Muslim immigrants for some strange reason. Its area is a mere 316 kilometers squared, consisting of three small islands with dry limestone hills and no rivers. The total population is just over 400,000. Malta received its independence from Britain in 1964 and has been a parliamentary republic since 1974. Malta entered the European Union in 2004, and it celebrates the 8th of September as a national holiday to mark the lifting of the Great Siege with the arrival of the relief fleet. Psalm 46 declares, God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed, and even though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn. The nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, the earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Remember what God of hosts means, God of armies. An audio of this message is on our Soldiers for Christ MP3 audio. It's important for us to know this. George Orwell, author of 1984, says the most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history. This is why Karl Marx said the first battlefield is a rewriting of history. It's important for us to know history. In my lifetime, I've heard people saying Muslims can never be defeated. So I made it a matter to study all the victories over Islam. And there's a lot of them. And the great siege of Malta has been well documented. There's some great books out, and these should be required reading for home education. They should be textbooks in Christian schools. It's also called the Last Battle of the Crusaders. Well, the Knights of St. John were the last crusaders. And these were angels in iron. That's an interesting way of putting it. The Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, the sword and the scimitar. This is a historic fiction book based on the event. You get all kinds of, like this Polish book, and history of the Siege of Malta, 1565, Birth of the Kingdom, the Crusader trilogies. These are different historic fiction books, Blood Rock, The Great Siege, Clash of Empires. And this is what it looks like today. That would be where St. Elmo stood. That is now where Valletta is situated. And this is what Fort St. Angelo looks like today. And a gun battery that took out the invading Janissaries would have been at the base right over here. Of course, the walls were not this high during the siege, but this is what the walls look like now. Of course, they built much bigger, stronger, higher, and better fortifications after the siege with much better funding. But these are where the original walls would have been. They just wouldn't have been this thick or this high. And the whole of, in fact, this now is going to Medina, their capital. And you can see they built to withstand bombardment. Phenomenal fortifications, really tough rock to crack. And the Knights of St. John flag, it almost looks like the Danish flag, but not quite, the white cross on red. And today they've got their monuments, their memorials, and the museum, which has got the cannon and the swords and the crossbows and the armor that the knights wore and some of the ceremonial swords that followed. And here you can see some of the ammunition pouches. And of course, by this stage, we're getting quite advanced in putting the gunpowder in paper so that you didn't have to measure out and you overdo or underdo. And so being able to insert the paper, put in the ball, very advanced ways of fighting for that stage before they came out with cartridges. These would be very heavy muskets that you could not carry unless you were Arnold Schwarzenegger, but they would be mounted normally on the walls so that you could take out a target much further away on the sides of ships or on the walls of ramparts and castles. And these are some of the captured armor, shields, scimitars, and muskets of the Arabs, of the Turks, the Ottomans. And some of the banners and memorials, you can see Valletta monument in this depiction here, standing over some defeated Turk, probably Dragut. And commemorations of the people of Malta, who of course suffered the same bombardment and contributed to the victory just as the knights and others. Some magnificent postage stamps that are there to commemorate this event, and in this case, the Battle of Lepanto, 7th of October, 1571, which the people in Malta, it's a Malta stamp commemorating a related victory. The Siege of Malta, 1565 stamp, and there's a whole lot of commemorative stamps of Malta. And today, of course, for the tourists, they have got the depictions, recreations, reenactments, and some of the colorful flags, swords, uniforms, orders of St. John. And this is what Medina looks like today. It's a high point of the island, dominates, and of course, a pretty solid fortress as well, even to this day. Reminding us of our Christian heritage and the principles of the Knights of St. John. No surrender, no compromise, no retreat. And Malta has put out this poster recently, no more mosques. We oppose the building of a new mosque in Malta. You wonder why they would have that view. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn. The nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. God uttered his voice, the earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Any questions or comments on the Great Siege of Malta?
Have you been there personally?
I wish. No, sadly not. One of the places I'd love to visit. Malta is a very small place, but what a great history. Looks like a magnificent place to visit.
It's famed during the Second World War as well.
It was. It was a very, very important point of the siege. And in fact, without Malta, Rommel would have won. Because the British ships and aircraft from Malta sunk most of his supplies, ammunition, petroleum, tanks. The Africa Corps would have won without the British naval base at Malta. Malta was absolutely critical to the British warfare.
And they day and nights relentlessly.
The Italians did.
They did,
but they were obviously built so strong. An island like that's built to resist. What an amazing place and history, yeah. So they had two sieges. So to distinguish between the Second World War siege of Malta and the Great Siege, the call of 1565, the Great Siege of Malta. So if you just Googled Siege of Malta, you might come up with World War II. Because it happened a second time.
My dad was he was in the British Navy for 5 years in the Second World War. And he was assisting one of the convoys that went through, with because they were trying to starve the people out and so on. And he escorted one of the convoys through. And he said the people were ready. I mean, they were literally starving.
During the Second World War?
When they got the convoys through. So he was on a destroyer, yeah. And they were taking food because...
Because I don't think Malta can grow enough of its own food. No. It's not an agriculturally compatible island.
Yeah. He said they threw rubbish off the ships, tea leaves and orange peels and stuff. And he said the people were sifting through it and seeing what they could
do. Oh, shame.
It was terrible. But they brought food and they resupplied.
I was just wondering about Martin Luther during that time. What was he up to?
In fact, that would have been 2 years after Martin Luther died.
Okay.
So it was just after the end of Martin Luther's lifetime. But Martin Luther also regularly prayed against the Turks, and even when the Catholic Austrians were fighting the Turks, the Protestants would be praying for the Austrian Catholics' victory against the Turks. They did recognize the difference between my enemy and the bigger enemy. Yeah, right. Yes. So on this point, it seemed like there was no Protestant or Catholic, it was Christian against Catholic, Christian against Islamic. So at this point, I think there was a general unity in Europe.
And I was just thinking, if the Turks were successful, then the entire Reformation would have not happened, especially after Martin Luther.
Well, you could go back further. So if you want to say that, imagine if the Muslims had taken Paris back in 732, the Battle of Tours, if Charles Martel the Hammer hadn't defeated them then, whole of Central Europe could have been open to Islam. You could also say if Vienna had fallen in 1526, if it hadn't been for... So there's key battles as well. So yes, you could certainly say if it hadn't been for the Muslims being able to resist, or the Christians resisting the Muslim assaults on Byzantine for centuries, what could have happened? And so, yes, it's absolutely vital to see if the Crusaders hadn't won centuries of time for Europe for the Reformation to happen, there wouldn't have been a Reformation. There wouldn't be an America, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, and so on. Exactly. Good point.
So, I mean, the Battle of Vienna was also a miracle. I mean, they only had about 15,000 defenders against a monster Muslim army.
Yeah, like 130,000 or something ridiculous.
Yeah, and the way those Poles came out of nowhere, you know what I mean, managed to get their cannons up onto the hills and bombard the army down there. It's incredible.
And King Soboski of Poland, if I'm not mistaken, he is in his 70s, on his horseback leading the charge, which is... riding a horse in your 70s is already quite impressive, but in armor, in battle, against the enemy, cannon and all that flying over the place. So, I mean, King Soboski's finest hour, for sure. Now, the Poles saved the day.
September the 11th. So the Muslims know exactly, they knew the...
They know the history,
the importance of that day when they attacked 9/11, because they understood that two of the greatest defeats...
Whoever chose that date, September 11th, chose a very... significant
revenge.
Date, very significant date. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, no, they know exactly. They knew exactly what they're doing. It was a revenge.
So we've got notes for tonight. Here's this Great Siege of Malta in my notes, and we've got the latest Christian Action newsletter has just been printed and it's uploaded and so on. Unfortunately, our postal service is so unreliable that we are. Putting it out electronically at the moment, but we've made a few hard copies for those who'd like. And also the latest Frontline News is printed out there too. So, and you'll see in the Christian Action, it's got the photo collage of the Women's Day outreaches, the March for Life and all of that too. Yes?
Just a little bit off the subject, but also on sieges. I saw the other night, one of the sieges when the Germans were laying siege to Stalingrad, and the Russians began to eat each other, the dead bodies.
Now you think of Leningrad.
Leningrad.
Leningrad, the north.
I heard the commentator saying that most of those Russians who ate the human flesh went insane. Most of them went insane.
I'm sure there are lots of reasons to go insane under a communist government, but that would tip you over the edge, probably, yes.
Consuming human flesh.
Yeah. No. Siege of Leningrad was really... savage. Indeed. Stalingrad was something else, but that wasn't a siege. That was just a slugfest. A German 6th Army totally surrounded, and they were being bombarded by not hundreds of thousands, millions of Russians were around them. It just that was ultimate, like Alamo in Texas or Rourke's Drift type of scenario, just multiplied by a few million. Yes?
So it just shows that in days gone by, they tried militarily to take Europe. Now, they know that Christians are so weak and so asleep that they can just move into Europe, intermarry, build mosques, and take over that way.
Now, that's a very important point, because it's not like Europe isn't under greater threat today than it was even then. But back then, they came in ships and they came with armor and they came with their banners flying and with weapons, and people recognized that's the enemy, we've got to fight and defeat them. Europe has gotten so asleep and they're so busy patting themselves on the back. We saved the world in these two world wars, which made everything worse somehow. But anyway, you've got to be grateful, even though they saved the Soviet Union and betrayed half Europe to communism. But you're not meant to ask those questions. Just, yay, yay, we won. war to end all wars, no more threat, go to sleep, take drugs, abort your babies, that sort of thing. And in the meantime, they're getting less and less. And just think of the fact that back before the Anglo-Boer War, the average Boer woman was having 12 to 14 children. In fact, Mrs. Kruger, Paul Kruger's wife, had 17 children. 17. Now, by the First World War, families of 8, 9, 10, 12 children was not unusual. Second World War, 5, 6, not too unusual. Afterwards, only child or adopted dog. So you've got the deterioration, so that Europe has gone from where the average married couple would have 4 or 5 children before the Second World War. Now they might have 1.2 on average. And in many cases, none, of course. That's just the average. Then they started talking people after telling Europeans, you've got to have birth control, you've got to have alternative lifestyles, and you've got to have abortions and so on. Then suddenly, we need more manpower to do our work. We need to import Turks and things like that. So you can see how the population control, abortion industry, Planned Parenthood has dovetailed with the Islamic agenda, a New World Order crowd, to where you could see within our children's lifetime the death of Europe. People like Pat Buchanan are warning of the death of Europe. He's written books like that. The demographic time bomb, that this Planned Parenthood abort your babies sterilization business is killing entire generations and countries and cultures. And at the same time, you've got a new Islamic invasion. So, yes, I'd say the threat today is more serious than it was in the days of Della Valletta. But they recognize the threat. Most of the people today would call you an Islamophobic bigot if you even noticed the demographic threat. So back in 2005, which is 15 years ago, I was a guest speaker at a minister's conference in Switzerland near Zurich, and there were over 400 pastors from around Europe from many countries, multilingual translations, and my message was reformation or Islamization. I warned the pastors about the danger. I'm talking about 2005. I thought the situation was bad then. And I was warning about, if you don't have a new reformation, Europe's going to be Islamized. Secularism and this weak form of Arminian, antinomian Christianity is no match for Islam. Nothing less than reformed Protestant Christianity on fire with revival is good enough to defeat Islam, as it was in the past. As Europe was threatened by Islam back in the days of the Reformation, only Reformation revival saved Europe then, and only Reformation revival will save Europe now. Do you know what the result was? They edited out my sermon to the point that while everyone else's message was put up on the audio and distributed in text and all of that, mine, they put a one paragraph and they changed it to Peter Hammond's message was on Reformation, no mention of Islam or Islamization, edited out the whole thing and neglected to upload either the text or the audio. Only one of it there. So the pastors were so embarrassed about a message of Reformation, Islamization, they didn't even want to report it on their website or to the people outside and just pretend like it hadn't happened. That's 15 years ago. And the situation has gotten exponentially worse since. So the problem isn't just the governments. The problem is the churches and pastors who are not willing to blow the trumpet and sound the alarm and alert people to a threat. If the watchman sees a threat coming to the city and does not sound the alarm, then their blood will be on your hands. We're talking about Ezekiel 3, Ezekiel 33, false shepherds, false prophets who don't warn their people. And so it's a very serious thing for us not to warn our people of different threats. And of course, the biggest threat is eternal judgment. It's appointed man wants to die and after the judgment, and the wage of sin is death, and we've got to have people fear God and day of judgment. But to not recognize even present threats to the church and the threats to our children and grandchildren's generation through Islamization, amongst many other threats, secularism, something else. But if you just put how brilliant to get Christians to kill their own babies through abortion and then get them to import vast amounts of foreigners, just mostly happen to come from Muslim countries, to replace them. If Somebody had suggested this when I was growing up. I would have thought nobody's stupid enough to fall for this. And yet they've suckered most of Western Europe. Fortunately, Eastern Europe's not listening. Eastern Europe's very hostile to this message of the UN and the EU. Yes?
Just if you look back a few years earlier, we look at the Reformation. What was the influence of the Reformation and Martin Luther for other places, people like the Knights and things? Did it have any influence on them or not really?
Oh, it did, because it revived Europe. You had phenomenal strength there. Europe, revitalized by the Reformation, managed to not just defeat Islam, resist Islam, but roll it back. Ultimately, all the way back to the gates of Constantinople. I mean, in the First World War, Christians were once again controlling not only the Holy Land and Jerusalem, but they were actually in Constantinople too. But once, as I just said, what would Richard the Lionheart have thought when his ancestors actually conquered Jerusalem and then didn't know what to do with it and then just gave it away? They actually defeated the Turks. They had Constantinople in. They wandered off there, and it's like they had amnesia. They didn't even know their history well enough. This is why knowing a history is so key. If you know your history, you will not be able to be guilt manipulated. If you know your history, you would recognize the threats. But that's why they want to keep you dumb from your history. The best way to defeat a person is to obliterate their own understanding of the history. So it's also important to teach a young people of great and brave people and deeds and times, because we want to create in people a sense of, even when everyone says, it can't be done, you've got no hope, give up. Got no, yes, they said that to people before, and they didn't listen, and they kept going, and they were rewarded with victory. Why must we listen to the naysayers and the prophets of doom and the Job's comforters? There's so much in the Word of God to strengthen and empower us. The Word of God should be making strong people. And if we pray the Psalms like Psalm 46, which, by the way, inspired a mighty fortress of our God, the battle hymn of the Reformation. So if we can learn history from a Christian providential perspective, it'll put steel in our backbones, hopefully some fire in our bellies, and put some resistance back into people. I'm glad to see that there are a few pastors out there who've got a bit of a Protestant spirit of saying no to the tyrants of today when they say you can't meet for worship and you can't sing and all this. I mean, this is the time for Christians to have this. Wait a minute. We've got a heritage. Resistance. Let's be worthy of the name Protestant.
So how come there aren't any good movies on this?
That is a great question. I've been thinking this would be... Can you imagine what Mel Gibson could do with an event like this? This is just... You could have a whole series. You could do a Lord of the Rings trilogy on it. You know, just the battles for each of the great forts, for example. It's just wide open for... Why do they make films on so much forgettable junk and neglect some of the greatest events in history? This is for... Sorry?
Muslims might bomb Hollywood.
Well... I would love to see a film made on the Battle for Malta. I mean, what a story. What courage. Now, may we have script writers, film producers, and directors of quality who will take up the challenge and produce a great Siege of Malta film.
I think you'd be called a religious bigot.
Well, I'm sure. Do you remember what they did to Mel Gibson? And yet... Passion of the Christ, one of the 10 most successful films in all of history in terms of box office. And that's after adjusting to inflation too. One of the 10 most successful. And he was boycotted by every single Hollywood everything. Vast amounts of cinemas in America, the chain ones owned by Hollywood, would not even show his film. Didn't stop it becoming super successful. Oh, they hated him. I mean, he took a lot of flack for it. But Hollywood hates Mel Gibson because he made a Christ-honoring film. But that's what we need. We need more people to go out and make films like... And there are people like Franz Cronier and the Kindred Brothers and others making some God-honoring films. And that's very good. But what we need also is historical films. Now, I know they're more expensive to make, but may God raise up people to do that. Something like this would... It would... I mean, phenomenal epic. You know, and they were going in that line of making films like Khartoum and Ben-Hur and so on. Why can't we expect some along this line. Also, David Livingstone, they've never made a really good big epic on Livingstone, or Henry Morton Stanley. Just his 999 days going down the Congo River, the Heart of Darkness. What an epic.
Cannibal tribes.
Yeah. Has there ever been anything like it? And but Hollywood hasn't touched him. They don't want it.
Hansi Prinsie's
brother, yeah. He's made some very, very, very good films.
I think a good candidate to write the script for such a movie would be Timothy Young. Because he's actually writing, I know he wrote a few books on history. Yeah. And
Small Paul's son.
Yes.
Okay.
And so we spoke about it actually, and the way he explained it really
good.
Brought it alive.
Well, I'd like to see the Frugals and Evangeline Young get out there and get together on some scripts along these lines. No, may God raise up a whole new generation of filmmakers that'll take up these sort of challenges, because most people are not going to read the books. But anyway, what we've got now is you've got some notes, we've got an article on the web. I'll send out the email next week with a link to the audio, the PowerPoint, and the video that we've screen captured from tonight. And hopefully we've got something to share with others. And just, I think every homeschooling family and Christian school needs to have a diet of Christian history and heritage and courage, which will inspire. Yes. This is all from Malta, but these are reenactors. So these are historical reenactors wearing some of the outfits and uniforms. And
for the tourists.
Yeah, it's for the tourist market, but I mean, this must be quite magnificent to go to Malta and get to the actual places. And I doubt that the actual ones would have had white socks, but anyway, I think these brown boots are more likely. But if you go to our castle, you can see some of the uniforms that the chaps at the castle had look awfully impractical, like white trousers. Why would you have white trousers in Africa when they've got mud streets? They didn't even have paved streets yet.
It's a white mask.
Yes, right, and a white mask. But isn't it amazing how some of the most obscure countries have some of the nicest postage stamps? Yeah. Okay, and to put history on your postage stamps, I don't see much good history from South African postage stamps lately, but you can go to Zambia and Malawi and you get David Livingstone and remembering great missionary events and scripture and IMSA. What's the case that so many countries aren't putting Christian things on the stamps? India, which isn't a Christian country, can bring out a postage stamp honoring William Carey, but Britain doesn't. But Britain will bring out one honoring Darwin, you know. Bizarre. So now you've got the pagan countries being more Christian than the old Christian countries.
And Crete?
Sorry?
Was Crete captured, or was it
Crete?
Yeah, I saw on the map that you showed.
Crete was taken by the Muslims, but of course Britain took all these back. I mean, they took back Rhodes, and they took back Cyprus, and took back Crete. But of course, at a certain point, this is the bizarre thing. Like, the high point being when Britain actually conquered Jerusalem, defeated the Ottoman Empire, was in Constantinople, didn't have a clue what to do with it. They'd lost their sense of what was right and wrong. They walked away, and as they turned their back, the Muslims slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Christians in Turkey. Smyrna, 1922, and the Royal Navy, the American Navy, the Italian Navy, the French Navy are sitting off port and watching while they killed 300,000 Christians in Smyrna, the last Christian city in Asia, and the Western Navy stood by and did nothing. Well, that's not true. They did worse than nothing. They repelled the Christians who swam out to their ships, poured boiling water on them and so on as they were trying to climb onto the ships, refused to allow them, pushed them off back into sea.
When was this?
1922.
No.
The death of Smyrna, documented. 300,000 Christians in Smyrna slaughtered under Ataturk, head of the Turkish army, and the entire Western world stood watching from offshore, from their naval ships, and did nothing. Greek civilization came to an end in what used to be the Byzantine Empire, 1922 in Smyrna. And that's the city associated with the Apostle John and Polycarp and it's in the Book of Revelation, Smyrna. And, I mean, this is the thing. When the descendants of the Crusaders finally got the Holy Land in Turkey, They did nothing with it and walked away. Which is totally bizarre, which is why your history is so important. I bet those people there didn't even know the significance of where they were and what they were doing. That's the thing. If you don't know your history, that's what happens. I've seen as I've gone along with, and now I've lived through 8 wars, and I've seen the biggest war of all is the battle for our history. And that's why I'm into writing history books, producing historic lectures. I think this is at the heart of it, because if we know our history, we will not be guilt manipulated, and we'll be more effective in evangelism and discipleship. When you know that the enemy's fighting in history, then we know we've got to be counter-fighting, counter-attacking.